When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. This ends the reading of God's holy and inspired word. Now, this morning, as we continue our survey of systematic theology utilizing the Westminster Confession, we come to this chapter on oaths and vows. We've been looking for a number of weeks at Christian ethics. We've considered the law of God, the moral law of God, then the civil and ceremonial law of God. Then we looked at two closely related topics, Christian liberty and liberty of conscience, what we've been freed from by Christ and his redemptive work, but also the liberty of conscience that we have no obligation to obey man's traditions or man's laws rather than God's. And then we've looked for 2 weeks at worship. And this week we come to oaths and vows, which are certainly a part of worship. We might think this is unnecessary, or may kind of wonder, why is this chapter included in the confession? It may not seem nearly as important as many of the other chapters. But one thing I think we have to recognize is in the historical setting, the Reformers had to deal with, or thought it necessary to deal with, the issue of monastic vows that Catholic priests took. They also had to consider the error on the other side of the Anabaptists, who had come to the conclusion that all vow-taking was sinful in the New Testament. And so because of errors to the right, errors to the left, so to speak, on all sides, they thought it important to address this issue. We're also going to find that they're going to address the civil magistrate in the next chapter. And we're going to see how this kind of ties in, because oaths and vows, particularly oaths, sometimes are, and most of the time probably, are civil. Sometimes they have an ecclesiastical place in a church court, but they probably more often apply to civil courts or oaths that may be taken of military service or the like. So they're trying to show that the Christian has duties in both spheres, in the church sphere as well as in the state. Now, R.C. Sproul asked the question in his chapter on this section of the confession. He asked, why are oaths required? And his conclusion is, well, because people are liars. He quotes Romans 3:4, John 8:44. But consider Isaiah 59:14, where we read, the truth is fallen in the streets. And so the keeping of the third commandment ought to help us keep the ninth commandment. And they're intimately connected, the third and the ninth commandments. Now this morning, we'll try to go through this whole chapter and talk about oaths and vows, or lawful oaths and lawful vows. Let's consider first the nature of a lawful oath in paragraphs 1 and 2 of chapter 22 of the Confession. There they say, a lawful oath is part of religious worship wherein, upon just occasion, the person swearing solemnly calleth God to witness what he asserteth or promiseth, and to judge him according to the truth or falsehood of what he sweareth. So the first thing they tell us is that oaths are part of worship. And they actually say it's religious worship. I think the thought here is that we're always, when we take an oath, we are invoking God's name. We're asking God to be a witness. And so it's obviously worship. Doesn't mean it's always an element of worship, but what it informs us is that it's part of our generic worship to God if we are called to swear by his name. Consider Deuteronomy 10:20. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God, him shalt thou serve. Here's the word, that word's usually translated worship. And to him shalt thou cleave and swear by his name. So fearing God, worshiping God, are intimately connected with cleaving to God, embracing God, and we're told there in Deuteronomy 10:20 that also swearing by his name is part of that complex of duties that we have as God's people. So it's part of worship. It has an element of worship. It is calling God to witness, we're told. Leviticus 19:12 says, and ye shall not swear by my name falsely, Neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord. So an oath, as Calvin says, is calling God as a witness to confirm the truth of our word. So an oath is made to man, calling God to witness. And they say there's two types of oaths. There's an oath that asserts, that swears to certain facts, past or present. You might take that in a court, where you take an oath to tell the truth and the whole truth. So you swear to be prepared to tell the facts. But there's also what's called a promissory oath. That's to swear to perform a certain deed. You would take that kind of oath as you came into a military office, wouldn't you? Take an oath of service. It's a promise for future behavior. And these kind of oaths, either asserting facts of the past or present, or promising future deeds, can be either civil or ecclesiastical. They can happen in the state, or they can happen in the church. But what the confession says is whether they happen in the church or the state, they're still religious in that you're still calling the God of all the universe to testify and to witness what you've testified. Thirdly, we're told in paragraph 2 that we're only to swear by God's name alone, and we're not to swear vainly or rashly. They go on to say, the name of God only is that by which men ought to swear, and therein it is to be used with all holy fear and reverence. Therefore, to swear vainly or rashly by that glorious and dreadful name, or to swear at all by any other thing, is sinful and to be abhorred. And we might sometimes hear people say, don't swear. Well, that's not completely accurate, is it? There's a time to swear. There are times to swear, and there are times to swear by God's name. But we can never swear by anything else but God's name. And when we swear by God's name, it better not be vainly or rashly. Deuteronomy 6:13 says, thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shall swear by his name. Something similar to Deuteronomy 10:20. Or consider the third commandment, Exodus 20, verse 7. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain. So who are we to swear by? God's name. But that's not enough. When we swear by his name, we better not do it vainly, haphazardly, without thought. Now in Matthew 5, verses 34 through 37, and I'd encourage you to look at that passage this afternoon. There Jesus demolishes the Pharisaic additions that had been made. They had various things that they could swear to, depending on how serious the oath was. They could swear by the temple. And, you see, they had gotten around the third commandment by developing other ways of swearing. James picks that up in James 5:12 and summarizes Christ's teaching. Remember, James is Jesus' brother. And the book of James has a lot of references back to Christ's teaching, particularly Christ's teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, because the book of James is a very practical book. And I believe here he's doing the same thing. James 5:12. But above all things, my brethren, swear not, neither by heaven, neither by the earth, neither by any other oath, but let your yea be yea, and your nay, nay, lest ye fall into condemnation. So these are the two passages that the Anabaptists picked up at the Reformation time and chose to interpret in such a way as to say there should be no oath-taking or vow-taking in the New Testament, because Jesus forbids it and James forbids it. And I think we have to understand the context. They are forbidding swearing by other things besides God's name. And we'll see another argument for that is all the examples of taking oaths in the New Testament. Paul does it quite frequently in his epistles. And so I think we have, by interpreting Scripture by Scripture, we have to conclude that clearly Jesus and James are talking about all these extra-biblical oaths that had developed by the teaching of the Pharisees. So we're to swear only by God's name and not vainly. We also, in the confession, they discuss the warrantableness of this matter. They go on to say in paragraph 2, yet, as in matters of weight and moment, an oath is warranted by the Word of God under the New Testament as well as under the Old. So here they're contrasting themselves with the Anabaptists. So, as a lawful oath being imposed by a lawful authority in such matters ought to be taken. They make the distinction, they say, in matters of weight and moment. In other words, you don't take oaths hastily over everything. And that's clearly what Jesus and James are getting at when they say, let your yea be yea and your nay, nay. You ought to be able to be truthful in normal conversation, to not even have to promise people things, much less swear to do something. But some of us have been in circles where that is fairly common, where people routinely, just for ordinary things, say, I promise I'll do that, or I swear I'll do that. And it's unnecessary, it's vain, and it calls into question, why can't you just say, I'm going to do that? In God's providence, I will be over this week to help you with that. And so that's what James is saying. That's what the divines are saying here. We shouldn't swear too frequently over small matters. Our yea ought to be yea and our nay, nay. If we say no, we won't, that ought to be sufficient for people to believe that we won't. If we say yes, that ought to be sufficient in ordinary matters regarding our truthfulness. But again, and this is one of the arguments against the Anabaptists, Paul in Hebrews 6:16 says this. As he's speaking about the covenant being established with God's people and God's faithfulness to His Word, as he's describing that faithfulness, he says this, he descends and goes from the greater to the lesser, and he talks about covenants amongst men, and he says, for men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. He says, sometimes when there's strife amongst men, it's time to swear by one greater. It's time to say, I'm prepared to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. And the other person in the controversy say the same thing to see what really happened. He says it brings an end to strife. Doesn't always solve every controversy, does it? People can still come and swear and still have different stories and you don't really know what the truth is. But Paul says it's more likely to solve a lot of controversies when that happens. For an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife. At least brings the strife over. There's going to be a decision one way or the other. And then the strife's over. And so, on that passage as well as the examples of Paul, we can conclude that it is right in matters of weight and moment to take oaths. And to do so when imposed by a lawful authority. Again, lawful authority not telling us to take an oath to sin, but an oath to do something that's righteous and just. Then we need to consider the weightiness of oaths. Confession goes on to say in paragraph 3, whosoever taketh an oath ought duly to consider the weightiness of so solemn an act, and therein to avouch nothing but what he is fully persuaded is the truth. Neither may any man bind himself an oath by anything but what is good and just, and what he believeth so to be, and what he is able and resolved to perform. Yet, it is a sin to refuse an oath touching anything that is good and just being imposed by lawful authority. So here they say it's appropriate to swear, but it's very serious. It's a weighty matter. Consider the words of Jeremiah 4:2. And thou shalt swear. Here's a command. This isn't an option. This is a command. Thou shalt swear, the Lord liveth, in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness, and the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory. We have the passage that we looked at last week in Isaiah 56. We have this passage in Jeremiah 4 where it seems to suggest that in the New Covenant period, as the Gentiles come in, they will swear, they will avouch, they will commit themselves to the Lord in an oath. They will make a solemn commitment to relationship with the triune God of Israel. And it's to be done, we're told, in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness. In other words, in truth, with no equivocation or mental reservation. In other words, without saying, well, I'm not really going to do that. That's mental reservation. Equivocation is, I'm saying it, and they probably think I'm meaning this, but I have another interpretation of my own regarding what I'm really meaning. But I know in the normal way that's spoken, this is what is being thought by the general population, but I'm going to read in it something else. So I'm not really committing to what everybody thinks I'm committing to. And that would be equivocation. So it's to be done in truth. It's to be done in judgment. It's to be done deliberately and reverently. And it's to be done in righteousness. It must be lawful. You shouldn't take a vow to sin or an oath to sin. And we shouldn't take an oath that we don't have a fixed intention on keeping, that it's possible for us to do it, obviously not perfectly, but purposefully, and we don't have a fixed intention to do it. Then we wouldn't be taking an oath in righteousness. So we're to take oaths in truth, in judgment, and righteousness. They are to be able to be performed. The proof text that the divines use is Genesis 24:2-9 in that. They also talk about it being a sin to refuse upon just occasions. And they refer to the oaths that were required to be taken in Exodus 22:7-11. But having spoken about the nature of lawful oaths, the fact they're part of worship, the fact that it's calling God to witness, the fact that we're to call upon God's name only and not vainly, and the warrantableness of oaths as well as the weightiness of oaths and the binding nature of oaths, let's think about the binding nature of them. Binding obligation. Paragraph 4. And oath is to be taken in the plain and common sense of the words. There's this issue of equivocation. Without equivocation or mental reservation, it cannot oblige to sin, but in anything not sinful being taken, it binds to performance, although to a man's own hurt. Not is it to be violated, although made to heretics or infidels. So here they address this truth and judgment and righteousness is to be taken truthfully. We're not to swear deceitfully, as the psalmist says in Psalm 24:4. Psalm 24, we're told, who will ascend to the holy hill? And we're told, the man that has not sworn deceitfully, the man who hasn't taken an oath or a vow and lied about doing it. That's the man that will be in God's presence. It also speaks of not taking an oath that would lead you into sin. And let me give you an example of that. In 1 Samuel 25, 22 and following, David runs into a man named Nabal. And Nabal is a froward, nasty man. His very name means that. He's a froward man. He's opposed to people. And he won't help David and his men, as David is the anointed of God. And David takes an oath to himself. I'm going to destroy this fellow. I'm going to make him pay. But then what happens? Nabal's wife Abigail steps in, and she talks David out of what he committed to. He committed to sin. And so he can be talked out of it. But remember Herod, children, in Mark 6:26. It says, "And the king was exceeding sorrowed." Remember what he's sorry about? His wife's daughter, because it was his second wife, his wife's daughter is dancing before him, and he says, "I'll give you up to half the kingdom." In other words, I'm not going to give you the kingship. You're not going to be the queen and rule, but everything else, whatever you want, basically, is yours. And she says, "I want the head." She goes, talks to her mom, John the Baptist, who's spoken against the unlawful marriage of Herod and her mother. And so she wants John the Baptist's head. And so her daughter goes and asks for it. Well, the king's already committed to give it to her. So it says he was exceeding sorry. He really didn't want to do that. "Yet for his oath's sake and for their sakes which sat with him, he would not reject her." He sinned by taking a rash oath, but he sinned again by carrying it out. He should have said, "Uh-oh, I blew it." But he was unwilling. It was for his oath's sake and for those that sat with him. He wasn't prepared to humble himself before those that were present and say, "I was rash." That would be wrong. But he went through with his rash oath. So having taken an oath to sin, we shouldn't sin. But having taken an oath that we may not like, but doesn't cause us to sin, we are still committed to. Psalm 15:4, "He that sweareth to his own hurt and changeth not." Psalm 15 is somewhat parallel to Psalm 24, speaking of the one that will be at the holy hill, that will come into God's presence. He swears to his own hurt and changes not. Sometimes he makes commitments that he doesn't fully realize the cost. But as the cost continues to grow and is larger than originally perceived, he still commits to do what he's committed to do, whether he rightly evaluated the cost or not, if it's not sin. So we see the binding nature of oaths. They bind us if we've committed to something lawful or something not sinful, even something indifferent. But they don't bind us if we've committed ourselves to something sinful. And I think we'll talk about Jephthah in a few moments. So now let's talk about lawful vows. We'll talk about Jephthah in a similar situation with a vow. Let's talk about lawful vows. Westminster Confession of Faith deals with oaths in paragraphs 1 through 4 of chapter 22, and then in paragraphs 5 through 7, they deal with vows. They say this of a vow: "A vow is of the like nature with a promissory oath and ought to be made with the like religious care and to be performed with the like faithfulness." I kind of wish they had maybe defined a vow here. Do you understand the difference between an oath and a vow? Pretty similar, aren't they? An oath is to man in God's presence. A vow is to God in man's presence. Most of the time, but sometimes it can be individual. It can be in our prayer closet with God and no men. Right? An oath can be asserting the truth of the past or the present, as well as promising something concerning the future. A vow is a promise of the future, but it's to God, potentially in the presence of men, not always so. So it's a solemn promise to God. It's a commitment to God. In Numbers 30, verse 2, we have the conditional statement, if a man bind his soul with a bond, and then it goes on to talk about vows. Binding our soul with a bond. It's a commitment. But it's a decision to commit. It's a voluntary commitment. And it can be personal or it can be social. In other words, we can make it to God by ourselves, personally, or we can make it socially in amongst God's people. Again, consider Ecclesiastes 5, 4 and 5 that we just looked at. When thou vowest a vow unto God, see, it's unto God. Defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better it is that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest not that thou shouldest vow and not pay. The way I like to describe Ecclesiastes 4 and 5 is that Solomon is making a distinction between option 2 and option 3. He says option 2 is not vowing. It's better to not vow than option 3, vow and not pay. But he's only implying there's a better option. Option 1 is vowing and paying. Vowing and paying is better. But vowing and not paying is worse than not vowing. That's his focus there. Now, we make civil vows. We can make marital vows, church membership vows, baptismal vows, as well as ordination vows. And guess what? We're going to learn about the civil magistrate in chapter 23, next chapter. We're going to learn about marriage in the following chapter, chapter 24. We're going to learn about the church. So membership vows are at least implied in chapter 25. Chapter 28, baptism. Chapter 31, synods and councils, discussion of church government. So at first, oaths and vows might appear a little bit out of place in the Westminster Confession of Faith. It might seem like a chapter that doesn't quite meet up with the importance of the other chapters. But I think, again, if you see it in light of, as we're going to get to, monastic vows, having to deal with that and that error, as well as deal with the error of the Anabaptists, the no-vow position, very important and very integral to a lot of the chapters that will follow. Now let's look at paragraph 6. Speaking of vows, it is not to be made to any creature but to God alone, and that it may be accepted, it is to be made voluntarily, out of faith and conscience of duty, in way of thankfulness for mercies received and for the obtaining of what we want, whereby we more strictly bind ourselves to necessary duties or to other things, so far and so long as they may fitly conduce thereunto. In other words, vows are to be out of thankfulness for mercies or for desiring for greater mercies. Consider Psalm 76:11. Vow and pay unto the Lord your God. Let all that be round about him bring presents unto him, that thou ought to be feared. So here in Psalm 76, the picture is thanksgiving for great deliverance. A vow is appropriate. But also we see in Psalm 132, verses 2 through 5, David's vows concerning his commitment to see the temple built and his vows of commitment to such. David, children, if you remember, he didn't actually build the temple. It wasn't until his son Solomon, until there was peace in Solomon's reign, that the temple was built. But David was actively engaged in acquiring all the building materials for that temple. He had a heart for it, and he vowed to God to work to that end, to see it accomplished. Then in paragraph 7, they go on to say, no man may vow to do anything forbidden in the Word of God. We already kind of considered that, right? Or what would hinder any duty therein commanded, or which is not in his power, and for the performance whereof he hath no promise or ability from God. In other words, if God hasn't told us to do it and promised to bless us in an activity, we ought not to be committing to that activity. Very interestingly enough, we have a chapter, a very large chapter in the book of Numbers on vows, chapter 30. And it's very interesting. In Numbers 30, we're told that if a man hears, is told that his wife or his daughter have taken a vow, he has an opportunity upon hearing it to annul their vow. Gives us a little bit of a picture of the headship of the husband and father, that there's a possibility of a rash vow being taken. And in the family, the father or the husband has an opportunity upon hearing it to say, that's not wise, that's not prudent. He can annul it. But Numbers 30 goes on to say, if he hears it and doesn't annul it, his non-action is an action that basically confirms the vow. But it does kind of tell us women that we all ought to be careful to take a vow. But if you're going to take a vow, you ought to consider running it by your father or your husband. And it tells us that we need to be alert, you know, to be cautious, to not take vows hastily, commit ourselves to something that's not biblical or that's not helpful to us. We have the example of Jephthah in Judges 11, 30 through 41. Does anybody remember the story of Jephthah? Just a little bit. Can anybody tell me what happens to Jephthah? Anybody remember that story? Yes. This is the fellow that killed his daughter. In chapter 11 of Judges 30, we read this. Jephthah was a judge. I'll read from 29. Then the Spirit of the Lord came upon Jephthah, and he passed over Gilead, and Manasseh, and passed over Mizpah of Gilead. And from Mizpah of Gilead he passed over unto the children of Ammon. And Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, If thou shalt without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever cometh forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering. Here's a guy that's been raised up by the Lord that makes a hasty vow that says, I'm going to offer up. I mean, he obviously must be thinking of a person. He had no vision that some sheep was going to walk, goat was going to walk through his doors. He had to believe it was a person. He was willing to offer human sacrifice to God. And the person ends up being his daughter. And it certainly appears from the text that he went through with that vow. There are some commentators that suggest not, because she is given an extension apparently. But in verse 40 it says, "The daughters of Israel went yearly to lament the daughter of Jephthah the Gileadite 4 days in a year." It certainly appears that she was put to death. Some contend her father required her to remain a virgin. But it doesn't seem to fit the rest of the text to me. He should have, like David, say, "Oops, made a mistake." Rash vow, just as David had made a rash oath to take care of Nabal. And he should have said, "That was sin. I'm not going to commit another sin. I'm not going to add sin to sin and offer my daughter as a sacrifice to God." Certainly God wasn't pleased with that sacrifice. And consider also Malachi 3:5. God says, "I will come near to you to judgment, and I will be a swift witness against the sorcerers and against the adulterers and against the false swearers." So I'll be a swift witness against those that violate the first commandment and enter into sorcery, worship false gods, the demons, or adulterers, violators of the seventh commandment, but also false swearers, violators of the third commandment. Now, I would say that there is no set form for vows and oaths, or oaths and vows in Scripture. We see several forms in which the Apostle Paul uses them in Romans 1:9, 2 Corinthians 1:23, 2 Corinthians 11:31. Oh, I should have mentioned Romans 9:1, as well as 2 Corinthians 4:10. So in Romans, two places, 1:9 and 9:1, 2 Corinthians 1:23, 4:10, and 11:31, Paul takes oath. But one thing we should recognize in oaths and vows is that when we take an oath or a vow, we either explicitly or implicitly. In other words, we either say it with the words, or certainly we're to understand that we do call God to be an avenger of our perjury if we deceive in what we've said. God is clearly a witness, and whenever we take an oath or a vow, we're to recognize whether it's an oath to others with Him witnessing, or it's a vow to Him by ourselves or with others witnessing, we recognize that we are committing in recognition that He will avenge our perjury. We have it explicitly in 1 Samuel 14:44, 2 Samuel 3:9, 2 Kings 6:31. These words, "The Lord do so to me and more also." In other words, in some of them, there is this explicit commitment. If I take this, I understand this is going to cost me more. And that's why Solomon can say, better not to vow than to vow and not keep. To whom much is given, much is required. If we voluntarily vow something, to not keep it is worse than having never entered into the vow at all. And that would be the same, I believe, for an oath. And then that's why the Westminster Divines speak against monastic vows. Vows, they say, of perpetual single life, professed poverty, and regular obedience. They're the three parts of a monastic vow. A commitment to a single life, a commitment to poverty, a commitment to what they call regular obedience. But in other words, willing to obey whatever the church says, regardless of whether it's consistent with what God says. That's what a monastic vow was. And so they obviously say that's sinful, because we don't know that God's committed us to singleness. We may be. God may, in His providence, cause us to remain single, but we have no obligation to say that we will. There's no added holiness to singleness. We are also not committing ourselves to poverty, for the Scriptures don't declare that poverty adds to godliness. There are godly that are poor, there are godly that are wealthy. And neither, obviously, could we ever commit to obey the church in all cases, even in cases where the church violates its laws, violate the law of God. So, obviously, they denounce monastic vows. Now, let me close with some application, just some quick directions for oaths and vows, for taking oaths and vows. All oaths and vows should be made deliberately. Ecclesiastes 5, 4 and 5. All oaths and vows should be made in truth and judgment and righteousness. Jeremiah 4, 2. All oaths and vows should be made humbly. Humbly. In other words, we're committing to perform something. We need to take it humbly. We need to be dependent upon God to assist us in what we've committed to. Think of Habakkuk 2:4, which Paul refers to twice, one in Romans and Galatians. Behold, his soul which is lifted up is not upright in him, but the just shall live by faith. Faith is opposite of pride. Fourthly, all vows should be made, I'm going to say, evangelically. Evangelically. Not legalistically. I'm making a vow, so I'll do this for you, so I'll earn your grace, God. We don't take vows to earn merit. We take vows out of thanksgiving. So we make oaths and vows evangelically, not legalistically. Psalm 116, 18. I will pay my vows unto the Lord now in the presence of all His people. I do it out of gratitude for my great salvation. I don't do it to earn my salvation. And then fifthly, all oaths and vows should be kept quickly and fully. Psalm 119, 108. Could also add cheerfully. I have sworn, and I will perform it, that I will keep thy righteous judgments. I have sworn, and I will perform it. A commitment of the psalmist in Psalm 119, 106. I've said it. I can never have option two. I didn't take it. I did take it. So now there's two options. Option one, I made it and I'll keep it. Or option three, I made it and I'm not going to keep it. And so he says, I will perform it. I will. The performance of it will be keeping God's righteous judgments. So let us be reminded of the need. We're liars. And God, in His infinite wisdom, He's given us sacraments. He's given us pictures of the gospel for our eyes. There are some of the Anabaptist stripe, the Quakers, who don't think they need the sacraments anymore. But God in His wisdom says we need them. And God in His wisdom says we also, as sinful, lying people, need oaths and vows in weighty matters that help us to be truthful. And so we ought to use them in their proper place. Not abuse them, not overuse them in daily life. In daily life, our yea ought to be yea and our nay ought to be nay. That ought to be sufficient. No need for promises, much less swearing. But in weighty matters, in the civil sphere as well as in the church sphere, there are appropriate times to take oaths and vows. And we ought to use them carefully for the glory of God and for our good.